I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I am chatting with returning guest Bayat Bodenbacher. He is creative director at Loyal Caspar in New York City. Last time Bayat was on, we talked about Promax's rebrand. This time, we're talking about what I consider to be a much broader and more impactful topic, which stems from an article he wrote that ran in Muse by Clio, headlined, "Can Symbols Change the World?" And I will link that in the post on Brief. Hi, Bayat. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Paige. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So when you guys reached out about doing something on this, it definitely was something I was interested in because I think, like a lot of people, I've been thinking a lot about symbols and trying to understand the importance of symbols, trying to understand why it's so important to remove the Confederate flag, why it's so important to remove certain statues, things like that. And then also on the branding side, removing Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben, stuff like that. You know, as a person who's spent a long time in branding, creative, working with marketing, why do you think symbols are so powerful? And what is it in symbols that humans respond so powerfully to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big question. And as you mentioned, I spend a lot of time thinking about that very same thing. You know, I think ultimately, it's one of the things that separates human beings from animals, right? Is our ability to communicate not just through sound and behavior, the things that we do, but also through visual expressions, right? Like written words and symbols. And I think what's so powerful about symbols is that obviously there needs to be a sort of general consensus about what the symbol represents, what it stands for. But it's still somewhat up for interpretation, right? So it means different things to different people. So in the article, for example, I talked about McDonald's arches and what those can mean for somebody who's traveling in a foreign country, right? It's something familiar, something I know. So for me personally, it brings back the memories of standing in a particular shopping mall in Switzerland with my friends and how excited we were that McDonald's was opening in my part of the world, right?
Yeah.
So, and that meaning can change over time. When I think about those golden arches now, it sort of has a different connotation.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I think more of the sort of strip mall capitalism or, you know, something else. So, and I think what makes symbols different from language is that it has that sort of emotional resonance. Language can be much more precise than symbols, I think, and you can have substantive conversations. That's why we have philosophical conversations with words and not with symbols, obviously. But symbols can sometimes be more powerful on that emotional level because it can tap into our emotional history with a brand and a symbol or a symbol. So I think that's why we've always used them to communicate on different levels through time.
And I think because it's interesting because I think in some ways they're universal, like you just said with the golden arches. And just a side note, I lived in France my junior year in college and I lived with a family for a month and the little kids were so excited about McDonald's.
Like, yeah,
laugh
exactly.
About it always because to me as an American at that point I was like, who cares about this, but they loved it. But I think so in that sense it's universal, but you know, in this current conversation that we're having about many of the symbols that I just mentioned, there are, and how you said that people interpret them differently and they mean different things to different people, but it's also, here's the symbol, it's out there, but is it doing what you want it to do? And do you have control over it? And I feel like you don't necessarily. You know, the symbol accrues certain meanings that you as a marketer or creative don't have any control over. So in that sense, I think that they're just sort of an interesting place to be. And then right now, I mean, even for me with the Confederate flag, obviously I understand what that represents, but I don't think that I innately recognize how emotional that symbol is for people.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I think that's ultimately the challenge, right? So for us as a people who like to control brands and shape them, right? I think we try to shape them as best as we can, but ultimately I think, you know, the ultimate meaning for every individual is kind of out of our hands. to a certain degree. So I think you're absolutely right. It's a really interesting challenge. But I also think that's what makes them so powerful, you know, because if it is that personal connection that people have with it, you know, if you take that away, I think they'll have a lot less resonance with people. But so it's kind of weird. You're absolutely right. You know, we're kind of we're doing something, and we're trying to sort of control the message. But ultimately, you know, we can do the best we can, but you know, we can't control everything.
Do you have any examples of how you've used symbols in marketing that where you feel like it's been effective?
I think ultimately, as graphic designers, right? I mean, that that's sort of our work, and we try to make these symbols as specific as possible. So when we build a new brand and we craft a new logo, for example, and ultimately the brand identity around it, you try to make sure that it's connected to what the brand stands for, right? And what we sort of, when we talk about it internally, we talk about sort of a logo or anything that represents a brand being a kind of an empty vessel, and you try to fill it with meaning. There has to be room in that vessel for everybody to put in their own meaning. In terms of specific examples of my and our work, I don't know. It's kind of hard to be very specific about certain brands. I think ultimately we just, you know, I try to craft marks that are aesthetically pleasing and are as universal as humanly possible. I mean, are you looking
Let
for
me
like,
say
a
this specific
example?
The specific example question is always hard for everyone, and I actually often don't ask it.
Okay.
Because I think when you ask somebody for a specific example, like whatever part of your brain it is that would deliver that immediately shuts down and is like, under no circumstances can I bring up for you one of the hundreds of logos that I've designed. But
it's hard in this context, right? When we're talking about sort of almost, you know, much larger issues, and then you're like, oh, I really like the sci-fi logo I made, you know? You know,
but I think that's actually relevant because, like, the sci-fi logo or the Coca-Cola logo, which I don't think you made, but flashed in my head, or even the man that designed the I Love New York logo just passed away in his 90s. But I mean, I was just thinking about how all the, like, sci-fi I can see in my head, Coca-Cola I can see in my head, I Love New York I can see in my head, and how those, I mean, even though we're talking about these very loaded symbols. But these logos are also loaded symbols in a different way. So as a marketer, do you think it's important that you know how to deploy that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, we should know how to deploy it, but it is almost, to a certain
luck.
Degree, it's almost, some of it is luck. You know, some of it is luck. Some of it, sometimes I refer to what we do a little bit of witchcraft. You know, there's sort of a certain magic to it that, again, sometimes you have no control over. And, you know, sometimes it's about sort of culturally hitting the right moment. You know, I think we employ experience and knowledge in terms of, you know, graphic design and positive shape and negative shape, and you know what certain colors mean and how certain people respond to certain colors. I mean, we try all those things, but ultimately I think some of it is a little bit out of our hands. I mean, it's almost a little bit, I feel like when making television shows, right, making content, I think a lot of people say, you know, ultimately you don't know whether something is going to work or not. Sometimes a show with the best intentions and the biggest stars and the most resources doesn't resonate with people for whatever reason. So it's one of those weird things. I think we do the work as best as we can, and you know, we hope that it resonates.
I thought about the TV show comparison too, that it is a little bit of magic and luck and timing.
Yeah, exactly. It's really odd.
The other thing I do think about brand work, graphic design, logos, because I've done a lot of interviews around that kind of stuff now. And I mean, they're all, if you talk to people who are in branding, though, all of that is incredibly determined. I mean, it's something that they sit, you know, you do a lot of focus groups, there's a lot of research done. There are reasons why they pick I mean, you know this better than anybody, but yeah. You know, there's reasons why you pick a font. It's why you pick a color, why you pick a palette, why you pick, you know, even a font size. All of it is so on purpose. So I actually find that part pretty fascinating, and how, because I'm sure as a consumer, you don't look at it and go, oh, it's a 14 point font and it's sans serif or whatever, and then apply some kind of meaning to it. But the reasons usually why all those things have been selected.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I guess that's our superpower, right? In theory, you know?
Yeah, if it works.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. It's extremely purposeful, you know, why one type of font evokes a certain type of emotional response and another one does something else. I mean, these are all, you know, details and nuances that we lose sleep over. In terms of the focus groups that you just mentioned, yeah, I mean, there's sort of more and more, especially as the entertainment space moves more into a digital environment where people who come from the tech side are more involved. So there's a lot more testing, a lot more focus groups. Some of that is helpful. I have sort of a love and hate relationship with that.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, it's just, you know, sometimes, you know, design 101 is still design 101. And if you make a font bigger and you place it in the right spot on an image, I can tell you that it's going to read better and I don't need to test it, you know? So that's how it works. It's useful. It's certainly useful in certain cases, for sure.
I'm going to wander afield and then I'm going to come right back. But I do, on the digital side, one thing that I think is also interesting is how, you know, if you're designing for like an app or for a phone, it's just like, here, do this little one by one icon, you know, so that also really forces a lot of thought. How can I put this brand into this tiny little button that's going to live on a phone that's going to have impact? So that part I always find interesting too, that, you know, and even sometimes there's sound related to it. There's a lot of thought that goes into that button that you push or swipe.
No, absolutely. It's a huge challenge. We have, as we start to work more and more on these digital brands, we sort of, you know, have more and more mini philosophies, if you will, around it. And one of them is, you know, if you want to be a big brand, you have to think small.
Yeah.
And it really is, you know, a logo needs to work at a tiny size now. At the same time, it still needs to have enough visual interest to be compelling on a billboard. So it's very challenging. And that is actually, I mean, we talked about the sci-fi logo a minute ago, but that's why, you know, we designed it in a way that it can be stacked. Mm-hmm. But it can also be vertical or horizontal. And when you stack it, it fits perfectly into a little square, right? So those are all things we need to consider. And it makes it really, really challenging. I mean, that is why, especially in logo work and mark work that we do, you know, I tend to think that we have sort of a European approach to it. You know, I'm Swiss. And so things need to be very, very simple and very clean for exactly that reason. You need to be able to read it at, you know, 75 pixels. So it's hard.
Yeah, I think it is hard. And I think it would be hard to do it in such a way where everything was distinct. Because at a point, it's like how many, you know, there's billions of these little buttons that people make and you only have so much space. So to be unique time, I think, is also challenging. I'm going to do something weird, but because I didn't prepare you for this, but there's context for it. So you mentioned that you're Swiss, and you said also that when you were back in the day. So when did you come to the U.S.? Because I want to ask you about symbols and like cultural context for symbols. That's why I'm asking you this. So how long have you been in the States?
Okay, so I moved to New York in 1998.
Okay,
from California. And I'd gone to school at Art Center in Pasadena. So I was there for 2 years before that. So that was, what, 96?
Mm-hmm.
And before that, in 92, 93, I did an exchange year in high school in California as well. So that was, So at this point, I've been here for more than half my life.
Most of your adult life.
Yeah, yep.
So the reason I'm asking that is because I was thinking about this issue. Let's take the Confederate flag specifically. So I was thinking about that issue, and I feel like that resonates with Americans specifically and probably Americans from the South differently than like me. I'm from Colorado. But as a European, I wonder what that symbol means to you. And truthfully, I was thinking about the Nazi symbol, which is obviously extremely powerful and is one where you know, like certain words here you just do not say. I feel like the Nazi symbol is a symbol you do not show. I don't think the Confederate flag is quite that level, but how do you relate to the Confederate flag and as you've watched the debate around that happen?
Again, because I didn't grow up with it, mm-hmm. and I've only, the meaning around it has, for me, has evolved, right? And I've right. only more recently become to understand what it really stands for. So in that sense, it's, you know, it very much was a sort of a half empty vessel that, you know, I put meaning into. Now I, you know, I have a much broader and deeper understanding of what that actually represents. That ultimately, yeah, it's about, it represents actions of a certain kind of people in power to keep and expand that power through fairly unethical behavior, through mm-hmm. violence and oppression, right? So mm-hmm. I think, and you asked earlier about, you know, how do I feel, or how do we as a society feel about some of these symbols being removed? I think when we as a society come to the conclusion that certain conduct of our past is now, you know, we now consider questionable or not ethical, I think it's about sort of admitting to past mistakes, right? I mean, I think, mm-hmm. and you mentioned the swastika, and I feel like, mm-hmm. you know, in Europe and especially in Germany, there has been a big sort of dialogue and debate and reckoning with what that symbol means. At least for me growing up, it definitely feels like Europe has sort of wrestled with that.
Yeah.
And I feel like and in many ways, I mean, that's why it's so disturbing, right? And it's always been disturbing when that sort of comes back, sort of neo-Nazi movements and right-wing violence. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely disturbing. In Europe, I know that in Germany and Switzerland, there are laws around hate speech. Like, you cannot say certain things. There's literally laws around that. So mm-hmm. I feel like, to a certain degree, maybe this country hasn't quite wrestled with that, with what that stands for enough. And maybe that's sort of what brought us to this moment. And maybe, hopefully, finally, we can, you know, as a society, kind of come to somewhat of a conclusion with that part of our history. I don't know. I mean, it's a really complex, challenging.
Well, I think it ties into another symbol that I had mentioned in my intro that I wrote and didn't say, but which is the mask, which is wearing a face mask right now,
right.
Which I think has also yeah. become sort of a similar symbol, and that for many people, it represents freedom. And I feel like with the US, it's about, you know, freedom of speech is a highly valued value. And so if you want to fly a Confederate flag, that's your freedom of speech. If you don't want to wear a mask, that's your freedom. And it's such an important value to us as a society. I feel like it's problematic for us right now because, you know, it's like, well, your personal freedoms exist here, but then when that freedom butts up against the freedom of other people to potentially not get sick or whatever, then you've got a problem on your hands. But I do feel like this wearing of a mask thing is another, it's interesting that it's taken on the symbolic relevance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I've always appreciated about this country, and it's probably one of the reasons, you know, that I'm here, is that freedom across a big spectrum of daily life. But that, I think you're absolutely right. When one person's freedom starts to encroach on somebody else's, in this case, health, right. you know, then I think we need to ask ourselves what's more important, right? Is it individual freedoms, or is it safety and health of the society at large? I mean, that's just kind of, that's sort of where we end up, right?
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it feels like, yeah, wearing a mask, basic and simplest form, is like, I care about my health and I care about the people around me, right? And if you don't wear it, probably doesn't necessarily make you a bad or uncaring person, but it does raise questions about how you view your role in a society that you depend on. And yeah, I don't know. Again, just like many other things, anything and everything seems to get politicized these days.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I feel like this is a very limited focus group I've done, but like very limited. But in talking to some people when I've been out about masks, I find a lot of people, at least around here, they're much more concerned about businesses than they are mm-hmm. about the pandemic, really. I mean, they feel like businesses should not be shut down and people should go back to work. And I feel like they don't trust the information about masks. So they're sort of wearing them begrudgingly. So that's interesting too, in that it's just the information is so inconsistent that people aren't, you know, everyone's coming at it from their own point of view. But I digress because I don't want to get into the politics of masks that much. I just wanted to talk about it as I just think it's interesting how the mask has become this incredibly powerful symbol when it really seems like a pretty simple act.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And listen, again, I look at a lot of stuff through the lens of branding, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the messaging that is being delivered when it comes to public health is so wildly inconsistent, and people don't know who to trust and what information is going to keep them safe. And that's really, really challenging. So as a brand, if I think of government as a brand, then I think of that. Mm. I think about government a lot in terms of messaging and branding. That is I think it's a catastrophic way to approach branding and messaging, to be so wildly inconsistent. That's really, it makes it really, really challenging.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's actually been sort of this inverse lesson in communications, which is, here's really what not to do. If you want to be effective in whatever it is you're trying to say, here's an example of what not to do, because you're sending 14 different messages at all times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely disastrous, right? And like, that's the one thing, you know, I feel like the number one goal or the number one job of a brand is to be truthful. Like if you're not truthful, you can't build trust with your audience. If in an advertising campaign, you tell people that your car can fly, people buy the car, they realize that the car can't fly, you have broken that trust, right? I mean, it's super, super basic.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing that you cannot do, is break the trust with your audience, with your consumers, and in this case, with citizens. And once that trust is broken, I mean, it's really, really difficult to regain it. I mean, it's one of, I thought about this a lot, you know, the whole Volkswagen scandal from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote an article on that too. And we always grew up, my family was a Volkswagen family. My dad just loved them. And, you know, it's literally the car of the people. And
Volkswagen.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's not an Audi, because, you know, we're not a flashy or Audi family, or a Volkswagen family. But then when that, you know, when you realize that the entire production of a great product got hijacked by wanting to sell more cars in a certain market, and you end up cheating in order to do that, that trust is broken. How do you rebuild that trust? It's very, very difficult.
I mean, I even think about that. What you just said is sort of a TV branding 101, meaning, let's say you've got a show. I don't have a good example coming to my head. I only have examples that work. I don't have ones that don't work. But let's say you've got a show and it's actually not that good of a show, but your promos around it are incredible. I mean, this happens all the time, frankly. Your promos around it are incredible. And then you drive people to go see the show and the show's not good. It doesn't just turn people against the show. I think it also turns people, not against, but it definitely degrades the trust in your TV brand a little bit. If they're like, I thought I was getting this and I'm not. So I think, that's always, and I do think, I've seen marketing outshine shows many, many times.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. We talk about that all the time. There's been numerous times when, you know, a television brand approaches us and they want to rebrand, they want to reposition, And, you know, repositioning often involves a tagline, for example.
Yeah.
And if you communicate something that sounds sexy and that may get people to the show, but the show doesn't deliver on that, it absolutely erodes trust in the brand. There's no question about it. So it's a really, yes, it's probably not, you know, not dramatic, but absolutely. I think it's, you know, in a world where everybody is, you know, fighting for people's attention and, you know, you're trying to find something to watch in a, you know, in an infinite environment where the choices are infinite.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, you're going to have, and if the brand doesn't deliver, if show doesn't deliver on the brand, I think that's a problem. Huge problem.
Have you ever had to go back to a network executive and sort of say that to them? Like this, like these two things aren't matching up, so you need to scale back this campaign or do something different. Have you ever had to have that conversation?
I mean, listen, we try to do that. I mean, I think sometimes we're not always looked at as the strategic experts, mm-hmm. you know, so sometimes we're not always, even though that's a big part of what we do. So sometimes, you know, we may not be listened to, but absolutely there's been cases where the messaging from the brand just isn't supported by the programming. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think we try to call that out. You know, I do remember a few years ago, there was a brand who wanted to, you know, reposition themselves all around being original, something like that. And
they had no original programming.
No, exactly. The original programming was like three shows. The rest was reruns. And it's like, that's not going to work. You can't do that. And we were.
You changed it to like partially original.
But I also know that the campaign didn't stick. So
I just would think that I could see that being a very tough conversation to have, because I think people at a point sort of fall in love with an idea or a campaign or whatever, and then, you know, it's hard to break it to them like these aren't matching. This isn't working.
Oh, of course.
All right.
Oh, absolutely.
Along the lines of branding, I think one of the things I thought was that's happened in the past couple of weeks that was interesting and that I ended up sort of seeing in a different light, but the whole thing about changing or pulling the branding on Aunt Jemima pancake syrup and pancakes and Uncle Ben rice.
Right.
And
right.
So I was thinking about that because, you know, on one hand, to some extent, you feel like those are sort of beloved. It's sort of beloved iconography. They're pleasant, friendly, smiling people. And if you don't really think about the history, you don't really think about what this is symbolizing. So, right. You know, getting your head around why that those icons might need to be pulled requires a little bit of thought. And I heard a story on NPR where they interviewed this woman who was the niece of a woman who had played Aunt Jemima. And this niece was actually saying she didn't want them to pull it because to her, it was part of her aunt's legacy. So I just thought it was interesting because I feel like as a culture, we get kind of caught up in a movement. And so then it's right. like, everybody must agree that this is bad or else you're bad. And so this is what must happen or else you're on the wrong side of the issue. So in that sense, I kind of appreciated it was a little bit more of a nuanced conversation about this symbology. But for you, you know, when you look at symbols like that, that come from, you know, 40, 50 years ago, and then at a point, you know, and this is true even for like the Cleveland Indians, right? There's some logos like that, the Washington Redskins, where people question, you know, should those be those brand mascots now? But what do you think about that, about how brands evolve and to the point where it's like, not only you're outdated, but now you're a little bit offensive. How do you think brands should handle that?
I mean, I think that's a really complex and I think also nuanced conversation, and it's also fairly complicated, right? So on one hand, so specifically about Aunt Jemima. So on one hand, I feel like I can totally understand how the niece, who has a personal connection, right? Was it the niece?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was upset about that, or is upset about that, right? So it's for her, it's personal. But I feel like, you know, to a certain degree, we get back into that same sort of conversation about personal versus collective, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing we talked about in terms of masks.
Thanks for pulling this together. I appreciate that.
You know, for the collective, that particular symbol has a different meaning than it does for, you know, that particular knee. So I wanted to dig a little bit into the Aunt Jemima thing. So I did a little bit of research. So my understanding
thank you.
Yeah. A couple of white entrepreneurs apparently bought a flour mill in the late 1800s. And then so after seeing an image of that sort of mammy archetype, they appropriated the name and the image of that and started to craft happy slave narrative around that, right? And that's where it gets really, really complicated, because it sort of starts out with a certain amount of cultural appropriation in order to sell products. And,
that starts off real bad.
That's really problematic. And then
over
the years, you know, this narrative sort of gets further exploited through this kind of post-Civil War nostalgia and Southern romanticism. So I pulled this and I wanted to read this. Literally in an early copy, advertising copy, it said, after the Civil War, after her master's death, Aunt Jemima was finally persuaded to sell her famous pancake recipe to the representative of a Northern milling company. So the narrative was created that she had also been a slave to a fictional colonel on a Louisiana plantation using a secret recipe from the South before the Civil War. So, like, that's really problematic if that's fictional. And then the image itself of the brand reinforces that status of Black people as the help. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then over the years, the happy help. Right. And then over the years, the logo gets refined and more sort of white beauty ideals get applied to the illustration. Right. So the fictional Aunt Jemima gets thinner. She loses a scarf, you know. And why is that? Is it to make us feel more comfortable with buying the product? So there's a lot of history of that brand that's really problematic, and I think to me ultimately comes down to the fact that a corporation led by white people exploit a stereotype of Black people for the purpose of profit, and that's problematic, and if we can come to terms with that and, you know, change that, then I think we're all better for it, you know,
said that way, it's not that nuanced. It's pretty straightforward.
it's kind of straightforward, but you still have to go a little bit beyond just the image. Like, I was thinking about this too, actually, independently of this. So I was at the store buying barbecue sauce, and it actually reminded me of Aunt Jemima, but a number of barbecue sauces have Black cowboys or Black
grill masters,
sort of. Yeah, exactly. Grill masters on them. And I was thinking about that too. And one of them, you know, I read in the back is like, I was thinking about it. Is that as problematic as the Aunt Jemima thing? And if I can believe what the copy on the bottle says, this particular gentleman started his own restaurant, made the barbecue sauce, and the restaurant is still there. So if that's true, I don't have an issue with that.
Right.
Right.
Because symbol of like entrepreneurialism and
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it just shows that you have to dig a little bit deeper, right? and you can't just take everything at face value. It's complex.
Yeah, that is complex, and I also think that's the piece of it that I struggle with, which is that do you then pull that logo of the Black grill master who's actually successfully running his own business, because you're saying it's a Black person. I do feel like you have to be willing to dig a little deeper. And I don't really think the typical American consumer spends that much time digging into any of this. But
I mean, and can you blame him? I mean, there's
no,
you know,
50, not really
50 barbecue sauces on the shelf in a grocery store.
Right.
And you know, you have to get back to making dinner or go to work or whatnot, and then you pick what you know what appeals to you. So no, it's challenging. There's it takes a little bit of digging. You know, in terms of the like the sports teams, mm-hmm. I think that's a whole other conversation. But ultimately, probably comes down to basically the same thing: is it a bunch of white people exploiting a certain kind of name or an image for profit? And if that's the case, then we'll probably get renamed or at least be on the table, you know?
Is it bad that I'm like, in corporate America is, you know, if you ask the question, is it white people exploiting XYZ stereotype for profit? The answer is probably yes, 85% of the time.
It's probably yes, you know? Yeah.
I mean
but that just shows how deep these sort of structural problems are. The structural privileges, it's really challenging. And how do you untangle all of that? And
embedded, get people thinking differently. And when actually to also bring this full circle, like you kind of did, which is, I mean, if people are like, I won't wear a mask, it infringes on my freedoms, how do you get them to go internal and say, oh, actually, I can understand why Aunt Jemima, Cleveland Indians, whatever, is somewhat racist and a problem. I mean, you are asking people, you know, when they can't even be bothered with X to dig in and do Y, you're asking a lot of them.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. And especially, I mean, we talked about, you know, the infinite amount of entertainment earlier. Mm-hmm. What about the infinite amount of information?
Yes.
The infinite amount of news, you know, mm-hmm. the messaging you're bombarded with every day, and how do you make sense of it, and how do you have time to dissect it all and process it and have conversations of substance about it?
That's a whole other conversation. And that's a whole conversation about media literacy, because there's so much.
Right.
Right. Like, I have this conversation more than I would. Enough that it surprises me, where people really truly don't believe certain things that I am like, this is a fact and it is not, it's ineffable. That does, other people don't think that. Like, we're not, everybody's living in their own fact-based world, separate from my facts and your facts are not the same.
It's incredible. I've been thinking about this recently a lot. I mean, again, I think I grew up with sort of the thinking, and as probably a lot of young people do, that there's a certain set of established norms and facts that sort of give us all a baseline of how we experience reality. And then you realize, wow, we live in probably 8 billion different realities, right? Because everybody experiences it differently.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that we're still debating certain things that have been established for literally so long is remarkable. I mean, the flat earth movement and all that stuff, there's still people talking about that. It's incredible.
If we go to flat earth movement, then we're going to be lost and here forever.
Oh my God.
Okay, so sort of talking about symbology and bringing it more, like something that just emerged was this whole thing of people posting black squares on their Instagram on that Tuesday. I will say I did it, but I feel like I felt a little like, maybe I don't know what I'm doing here, and maybe should I be doing this? Should I not? Am I just being knee jerk? I definitely thought about it. But do you think that people posting symbols like that collectively has an impact, or do you think it's people just sort of, are they trying to sort themselves? Like, this is where I fall on this issue. What do you think that means when people do stuff like that?
Well, first of all, I posted that square too. We're raising our hand.
We posted the square. Come at us.
But to me, actually, it was interesting that you mentioned the square, because to me, it was actually more sort of the absence of an image, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to a square,
well,
right?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, on the surface, it stands for sort of public display of solidarity, which I think mm-hmm. is a great gesture. But, you know, as I said that in that article too, ultimately symbols are only as powerful as the actions behind them. So mm-hmm. the intention is great, you know, but what are the actions behind it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're trying to have conversations with our kids around Black Lives Matter and mm-hmm. what it stands for. We've gone to protests. were, like a lot of families probably, were reading Abraham Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates, and, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I think a lot about power and politics through the lens of branding and messaging. So I definitely think overall there's kind of a re-education that's happening on a family level, community level, and national level. So I think, yes, solidarity is great, but ultimately what are our daily actions, right? So the thing about social media is that I'm still trying to sort out, there's a certain sort of performative aspect of it, right? So mm-hmm. we post pictures of our perfect meal, we post pictures of our great family. All of it is sort of a highlight reel of our lives, right? Or what we want other people to think our lives are like. So in that sense, I'm still trying to sort it out, because you mentioned Milton Glaser, right? Milton,
did I?
Yeah, you did. Well, you, the guy who,
oh, the I Love New York guy, yes.
Mm-hmm. The I Love New York logo, right? So he mm-hmm. passed away earlier this week. And it was sort of a similar for me thing to me, you know, a lot of designers posted tributes, and rightfully so. And a lot of posts were pretty heartfelt, but other ones just kind of felt like people raising their hands and saying, hey, I know about Milton Glaser too, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, and I considered posting something, but then I was like, well, if that person is important to me, why can't I just grieve or be sad in private? Why do I need to display that publicly? So I feel like it's sort of a similar thing. I think on the surface, it's great, but ultimately, it's the actions that count. So, right? So what are we doing about it? And I think you mentioned sorting. I absolutely think that there's a lot of that going on. Yeah, for good or for worse. But at the same time, when you realize that your aunt, your Republican aunt in the Midwest, is posting something about Black Lives Matter, then you know that it's reaching more people than it has before, right? You know that something mm-hmm. is happening. And yes, maybe, you know, I don't know if it's performative or not, but just the fact that it happened is probably a good thing.
And yeah, you're right. And then it gets people talking, or people are like, why are all these black squares here? I don't know if I think it hurts anything. I do think it can be, you're right, performative and nothing else. But at the end of the day, is it more harmful than beneficial? I don't really think so. But I do think I've had Linda on a couple of times, and she asked the question, if you didn't have social media, what would you do? Like, how would you demonstrate your feelings about this? And I think that's, you know, a good question. Would that mean that you would be more likely to go out and protest, or, I don't know, put a flag in your yard? What did people do before social media when they wanted to demonstrate where they stood on something?
Yeah, I mean, I think you went out and protested, right? But I think that it was much harder to organize, wasn't it? I mean, the speed with which some of these things get organized these days, right, for good or bad, is pretty incredible. I think it took a lot more effort, you know, on
back in the day.
side of activists and community organizers, and, you know, to get the message out. But listen, maybe because it took so much effort to talk to people and educate them, maybe, I mean, were the actions more powerful then than they are now? I don't know. I mean, in this more recent case, I think it definitely, the uprising is still going strong. So I feel like maybe it's just the actual cause that people need to believe in, and needs to be strong enough for people to want to rally around it. Yeah, I'm not a social media expert, so, you know, I don't
No,
know.
Me neither.
I can only observe.
You mentioned that you had been talking to your kids and family about this. I just wondered, how old are your kids?
My boys are 11 and 13.
Okay, so that's an interesting time to be having these conversations with them, because they're old enough to kind of get it. So what is their, like, how are they responding to it? How are they processing this?
I think as well as you could hope. Again, you know, we're trying to engage them in conversations. You don't always know what goes on in people's brains. But, you know, my son actually came up the other day in the morning and said, Mom, I can't believe that there are some people that still don't think that white privilege is a thing. So I think it's resonating. Mm-hmm. I think it's especially important to have that conversation with two white males, right? Who are going to be growing up in this world? Because I mean, I think that's what a lot of people are saying, right? That the shift is going to need to happen with white people mainly. So I hope it's sticking. We're trying our best, I think.
Well, thank you for having those conversations with your kids. I think that's a big action that people can take. I wonder what they can do. You can talk to your kids. Okay, well, we kind of covered a lot of ground, but I appreciated it. And I really appreciated your Aunt Jemima research. Thank you so much for doing that.
Well, I've been thinking about it for a while, but I really wanted to, you know, get a little bit deeper there. I sort of had an instinctive reaction and sense around it. The little bit of research I just kind of confirmed some of my feelings around it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bayat. I appreciate it. And I'd love to have you on again, so we will talk again.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Paige. Take care.
Okay. You too. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this episode of the Daily Brief podcast. If you don't already, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for conversations, please feel free to reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org. And as always, thanks for listening.